Today we honor the first martyrs of the Holy Roman Church. As I said, it's a kind of companion feast to what we celebrated with great solemnity yesterday, the apostles Peter and Paul, who are also martyrs of the Holy Roman Church. Rome, of course, was the seat of the empire, so when the empire or when the emperors decided to turn against Christianity, Rome was the first place. That was the easiest targets. This feast in particular focuses on the victims of the Roman Emperor Nero. Nero, who famously blamed the Christians for a terrible fire in Rome. Some of the accounts say that Nero planned the fire, but whatever it was, he blamed the Christians, and the torments that they devised for the Christians were extreme. There were many of them who were not only crucified, but then set on fire while they were still alive on the crosses to light up the way along the roadside. They're the first martyrs of the Church of Rome. They're not the last. We know that many of the Roman emperors were also cruel. Nero was in the first century, but the persecutions went on for 250 more years. You know some of the stories of the martyrs in the Colosseum, where the Christians were basically used as entertainment for the crowds, thrown to the beasts, victims of the gladiators and all different things. So the blood of martyrs flowed in the city of Rome, not only in the year 64, but for years afterward. Here in the Ordo, it gives this description of today's commemoration. The church celebrates this feast in memory of all the martyrs in the persecution under Nero around 64 AD. Many Christians of all walks of life were martyred at the hand of this emperor. This celebration reminds us that Christians should seek sanctity regardless of their social status, age, or skills. I was a little surprised to read that because typically the Christians were the poor. That's why they were easy to be made into targets. But there were also Christians who were not poor. And as this says, they came from all walks of life. One thing about the honoring of a group of martyrs like this, it reminds us that martyrdom is not always acclaimed as the victory of a hero. Maybe in our worldly way of thinking, we could say, well, if I'm going to be a martyr, at least I could be a hero, at least I could be famous, at least I could unleash a wave of conversions by my heroic sacrifice. That's not usually how it is. Many martyrs have been completely forgotten. We don't even know who they are. We don't know their names. They're not famous. In fact, most martyrs in church history are not famous in the worldly sense. In heaven, they're famous. But on earth, no, they're forgotten. So if that idea that we could attach some kind of worldly glory to making a sacrifice of ourselves, that's just mixing two different things, apples and oranges, right? It's earthly glory is of no value in heaven. So you don't have to be famous or popular or make a public display in order to be a great martyr. Martyrs have a mentality that transcends this world. They're not focused on what they gain here. They're focused on what they gain in heaven. They're willing to sacrifice everything here in order to gain the great treasure of eternal life. That's who we honor today. So we don't allow worldly motives to stain the heavenly motive, which is eternal glory, which is God's own desire for us. Okay, let's take a look at the readings of today. First of all, the prophet Amos has some challenging words to say to the children of Israel. Amos was the great critic of the social ills of the Israelites. Well, actually, he criticized the others too, but the Israelites get the brunt of the prophet's criticism because the people have turned away from God. They have grown comfortable in their luxury. They've forsaken the covenant, and so they need harsh treatment, not because God hates them, but because they need something to push them to conversion. So when we read the Old Testament expressions of God bringing down punishment on evildoers, it's correct, but we shouldn't interpret it in an earthly way. Bad guys get punished and good guys get rewarded. It doesn't always work like that. In fact, some of the language in today's psalm we have to understand properly. It says here, "You hate all evildoers. You destroy all who speak falsehood. The bloodthirsty and the deceitful, the Lord abhors." Well, he doesn't hate anyone. He doesn't hate evildoers in the way we think of it. What he hates is the evildoing. He hates sin. He doesn't hate the sinners. Why does he bring punishment on evildoers? Not because he's mad at them, but because that's the only way to bring them out of the trap of sin and let them and set them free. So punishment from God's perspective is a remedy, not simply divine wrath. In fact, it's not really possible for us to sort out the reasons for God's allowing us to suffer punishments. Look at what happened in Rome. The Christians are the ones who bear the punishment, and that they were not the evildoers. So the logic that we see from Amos and from the psalm doesn't seem to apply. If God just hates evildoers and he makes them suffer, we would understand it. That would be simple justice. But it doesn't work, because sometimes the evildoers get punished. Sometimes the Christians get, the good people, the holiest people, sometimes get the worst punishment. So we cannot limit ourselves to an earthly evaluation or an earthly calculus about how it all works. Instead, we recognize God's intense love for all people gives the reason why everything happens. When the prophet Amos says, "Now I will deal with you in my own way, O Israel, and since I will deal thus with you, prepare to meet your God, O Israel." It sounds like a threat. In fact, it's not. It's an expression of love, but tough love, harsh love, love that the person who is loved will experience as a trial. Now, is that what the martyrs of Rome experienced? Well, in a certain way, yes. They also experienced the harshness. Not because they were evildoers, but because they were being set free from everything that this world offers. They were being stripped, but not in order to be left with nothing. They were stripped in order to be filled with something greater. So there's a mysterious process going on here. When we suffer, are we being punished for our evil doings, or are we being stripped for greater glory? Well, maybe both. What we can be sure of is that God has something much greater in mind for us than we can even imagine. That is certainly true. Even though we are sinners, even though we deserve punishment, that's not what God has in mind. If he thinks we have to suffer, it's so that we will benefit more. Okay, in today's gospel, we see two different ways of evaluating hardship. this is the story, or one of the stories, of the apostles with Jesus in a boat on the sea. This is the Sea of Galilee, or the lake. And this big storm threatens their lives. So it's a real storm. It's a real historical event. But we can also interpret it symbolically. As far as the historical event goes, I don't know. Well, we wanted to go to the Holy Land, right? But the war prevented us, so we didn't go. I've never seen the Sea of Galilee. It's not an ocean. It doesn't have tides or tsunami. It doesn't have storms like an ocean can have. But it does have violent storms. From what I've read, even though it's not a huge lake, it's big enough that if the wind is strong, the waves can become large, and because the boats aren't that big, they get threatened. We're not talking about ocean liners here. We're talking about little fishing boats. And these are fishermen. They know how to handle boats, and they know what it's like to be on the water in a storm, although in most cases, because it's not that big, they would get to shore as soon as they could. But here, they're caught in the sudden, violent storm. As I say, we could take it symbolically. There's two elements, right? There's wind and there's waves. In the case of a lake, the waves are always the result of the wind. They're not because of the tide. So if there's a strong wind, that results in big waves. And this is actually accurate for the spiritual life. That if you think of the wind as spiritual forces and waves as consequences of what happens in the spiritual world, it's accurate. The wind is actually the worst part, and the waves are a consequence. Anyway, Jesus is in the boat and he's asleep, as if he doesn't care at all about wind and waves. What is this revealing to us? Well, there's another way to interpret what's going on. There's God's way. There's the human way, which the apostles express very, very strongly. We're perishing. Help us. Wake up and save us, Lord. And then there's the divine way of interpreting it, is I have everything in control, and I'm not going to worry about wind and waves, as if that's what's most important. In fact, even perishing on the sea is not the worst thing to happen. Dying from a storm is not the worst thing to happen. Dying due to sin, dying in a state of sin, that's the worst thing to happen. Going to hell is the worst thing to happen. That's why God will do anything to save us from eternal damnation. He'll do anything. He'll sacrifice himself for us. Not just to stop wind and waves, but to stop condemnation. Anyway, what I'm pointing out here is there's two different ways of reading it. The human way is, this is the worst thing that can happen. We're going to be dying here. We need to be saved. Jesus gets up and says, "Why are you terrified, O you of little faith?" As if to say, don't look at this only from a natural perspective. Look at it with eyes of faith. You have little faith. With faith, you should be able to see that I'm with you and that I'm your source of security, not the boat, not the changes in the weather, me. And then he immediately shows them why they don't have to be terrified. He rebukes the winds and the sea, the waves, the two elements, and there is great calm. Like that. Then they are amazed. Who is this? What are we in the presence of here? What sort of person has authority over the wind and the waves? Well, only God has control of the wind and the waves, and he's present in this man, Jesus, who was asleep in the boat. This understanding is what made it possible for the martyrs to persevere. Going back to the first martyrs of the Holy Roman Church and all the other martyrs, how could anybody think that they could persevere through such horrible torments, or even the threat of such torments? Because from a natural perspective, we don't have to be burned alive on a cross before we realize we don't like that. Just hearing about such things is enough to intimidate us. And you would think that Nero's threats against the Christians would be enough to stop them. Because who wants to go through that? But what actually happened was, in spite of the great persecution, the church grew. The church flourished in the time of persecution. Not because people wanted to be tormented. It was because people recognized the presence of God, the power of God in Jesus Christ, and the great treasure of the life of faith. Yes, people were inspired by the example of the martyrs, but that's only because they had the grace of faith. On a natural level, there's nothing great about seeing people tortured and killed. There's nothing that would make you want to do that. Only faith. And faith makes it possible for us to transcend all earthly suffering. Now, it doesn't mean that we will never be afraid. Jesus himself experienced fear. Maybe not in the boat. No, he was asleep, so he didn't have to be afraid. But here he's revealing his absolute authority over natural phenomena. But he still has a human nature, so he still experiences fear. What faith makes possible is to transcend fear, to not be in the grip of fear. This came up a couple of weeks ago in the Sunday readings. And this is very important for us, because fear cripples us, blinds us, stops us. It distorts our perception of what's really going on. Faith is what opens our eyes to what's really going on and what's possible for us. So when we're facing a storm, the temptation is to give in to fear. The challenge is to open ourselves to the way of faith, to see with eyes of faith. And that's what makes it possible for us to be victorious, to be eternally victorious, not by our power, but by the power of God at work in us through faith in Jesus Christ.